Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Our quote for the day, Ben Franklin, if you would be wealthy, think of saving as well as getting. A fine suggestion. An industry survey shows a record 5.4 million American homeowners with a mortgage, or nearly 12%, are either behind on their payments or in foreclosure at the end of last year. This is downright scary. Predatory lending with a smiley face. I want to get into this with Alan Jablonski in just a moment. Debt collectors calling up people who are dead. I mean, it's going on stranger and stranger. And the European Union has slapped tariffs on U.S. biodiesel. Everybody is protecting their economies except us. Gee, what is it that they all know that we don't know? I don't know. We'll have to figure it out. Right now, though, Alan Jablonski is with us. Yesterday, when I was sharing with you my overview, my understanding of an overview of what was going on with this mortgage assistance, the homeowners mortgage assistance program, you know, all I had were the facts that were in the Wall Street Journal, a few other financial journals that had just been released by the Treasury Department, and no deeper understanding of the meaning of them. And a couple of people called in and had questions. And I said, you know, I'm not an expert on this stuff. I'm just reporting the news here on this. And, you know, I have a take on it, but I don't have the info. And so that, of course, set off the alarm bells for all of us. We need to get our favorite expert on, Alan Jablonski, ajconsumerwatch.com. And Alan, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you, as always. Alan, what's the deal? Tell us, give us an overview of the program.
Well, there's two parts to it. There's the Home Affordable Modification Program, and there's the Home Affordable Refinance Program. The refinance program will be for those people who are not underwater in their home, that don't owe more than their home is worth. But the real focus of this program is the modifications. And basically, 2 weeks ago, when we were discussing the proposal and nothing was down on paper, they were stating that there was going to be a 105% loan-to-value limit on this program. Basically,
in other words, you could only do it if you were 5% underwater.
Correct. And now they have thrown that out the window.
Yeah, it's down to 80% now, isn't it?
Pardon?
It's down to 80% now, isn't it?
Well, no. What they're doing is that they have lifted that, right. And you can owe $150,000 over your $500,000 home. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how far you are upside down in your house. Right. You can qualify for this program.
Yeah.
Now, there are certain guidelines. Part of the problem is, Tom, is that this program, again, is voluntary on behalf of the investors and loan servicers. So the onus is on them to start participating. And we're going to see in the next 3 to 6 months whether or not the loan servicers start registering with the Treasury, because they have to do that. Right. To participate into the program.
Alan, I saw that they were offering $500,000 and $1,500 bounties, basically, or bonuses for originators who are generating these loans. And my guess, and I shared it with my listeners, but it's just a guess, I'd love to reality check this with you, was that the hope of the administration, or maybe it's even written into the law, was that that would be what's going to spiff the people on the ground, the individual people who are out there, selling these products, as it were, because you know, the reason that, so many people, I think some 60% of all the subprime mortgages were actually given to people who qualified for prime mortgages. They were never told they qualified because they got these loan originating individuals, the mortgage brokers?
Loan officers.
Yeah.
They can work for lenders or
right.
For
they were making a higher commission on the subprimes than they were on the primes, and so they were out there hustling those things. And so my guess is that the government is trying to spiff these folks and therefore encourage them to participate. Or is that $1,000 is going to go to the bank? How does that work?
Well, there's incentives for both the homeowner and the loan servicer. They're not giving any money to the individual loan officers who may be working for a loan modification company.
Right.
That there isn't any bounty per se.
Right, but if they give it to the company could bounce it down because they're making it clear to the whole world how much the amount is. So the
the incentive is $1,000, $1,500 up front. And then $1,000 per year for 3 years to the loan servicer. To participate in this program, they're going to lose far more than that. So the financial incentive that they're given isn't very strong.
Right.
And the financial incentive to participate for the homeowners, they get $1,000 a year
off their
principal.
They
stay current through the first 5 years. But I got to tell you that the homeowners, the vast majority of homeowners across the country don't need an incentive. They love their homes. They want to stay in their homes. Mm-hmm. They don't need $5,000. It's very nice that the government's going to give them that.
Right.
But they want to keep their homes, and it's up to the lenders, the loan servicers, and the investors to start cooperating.
So, first of all, we're talking with Alan Jablonski, ajconsumerwatch.com, licensed mortgage broker as well as an attorney and the author of Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. And, Alan, your broad sense of this as a program, my sense of it was, and this is what I said yesterday, that this is a start, and probably a good start, but this is nothing close to what Franklin Roosevelt did with mortgages back in the 30s.
It's a step in the right direction. What really needs to happen is what's happening in the House right now, where they're bringing to the floor the possibility of bankruptcy judges being able to modify loans. Mm-hmm. If that is the case, we attorneys will be able to go in and modify loans and probably receive principal reductions instead of lenders basically trying to keep their investors happy.
Right, because the banks, when they did this bankruptcy reform bill a couple of years ago that some Democrats, much to their discredit, including Joe Biden, were advocates of, carved out home mortgages as something that were – well, you know more about it than I do. It was a special category of some sort that really was very difficult to bankrupt yourself on. Do I have that right?
Yes. Well, the part of the problem here is that people are hearing that, you know, we may be hitting a bottom in home prices, and they're hoping that the government's going to come riding to the rescue. Mm-hmm. And there may be some help down the road, but right now there's a $1 trillion worth of option arm loans hanging out there that are due to reset in the next 3 years. The good news about this new proposal is that you don't have to be in default to qualify for the program. And if the House and the Senate pass the bill that give the judges a little bit of authority to modify loans that work for homeowners, then we're going to be able to go in and say, look, we have a homeowner who won't recast for a year, mm-hmm. but he's in imminent
danger
of defaulting on his loan, so therefore you better work with us or you're violating this law.
Would that require first of all, if you think this is a good piece of legislation, we need to get the name of the legislation out and have people call their members of Congress and say, hey, you know, push for this and who the sponsor is and all that kind of stuff. But secondly, is that going to require somebody to declare Chapter 7, 9, 11, whatever it may be, 13? I don't know all the various chapters of bankruptcy you do. Is that going to require them to declare bankruptcy, or is there some provision that's short of bankruptcy that they
Nothing is set in stone right now. The law is still morphing, and from what I understand, they may bring it to the floor next week. I don't have the HR number offhand right now, but I will put it on my website and people can go check it out. I'll have it on there later this morning. I didn't want to put it up there just for the fact that nothing's set in stone right now, but what they are discussing is that a homeowner will have to file either a Chapter 7 or Chapter 13 bankruptcy.
Yeah, okay. So people can go to ajconsumerwatch.com a little later on in the day and get the details on that. But that's the thing that's coming down the road that's being worked on that may be a more solid solution, because this program that has been rolled out right now is largely voluntary on the part of the banks to participate, and most of them are going to lose money to participate. Why don't the feds simply say, you want any more billions of bailout dollars from us, Mr. Banker? You've got to go along with this program. Alan, let's pick that up on the other side of the break here, if that's okay, and we'll take some calls from listeners.
Excellent.
Okay.
Look forward to it.
Alan Jablonski is with us. He is a consumer rights attorney, a licensed mortgage broker. He's the author of Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. His website, ajconsumerwatch.com. Our phone number, 866-987-TOM, 987-THOM, and 503-796-2324.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Everybody here comes from somewhere that they would just as soon forget.
Taking back the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Alan Jablonski on the line with us. AJConsumerWatch.com is website. He's a consumer rights attorney, a licensed mortgage broker. He knows this business inside out from every direction, 16 ways to Sunday. He's the author of Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze, and he'll be taking your questions in just a moment. Alan, just to finish recapping this two-part program that actually is the law right now, that is being the process of being rolled out by the Treasury Department. When will people be able to have access to all the details into the program? How do they do it? Do they contact their mortgage lender? What's the point of contact? How do people get started with this?
The first thing is to visit the government website. For the very first time, the Obama administration has set up a specific website, which is financialstability.gov.
Okay.
And homeowners can go there. They have questions about the refinance and modification, and you look at the questions. You click on yes, if I answered yes to all these questions, go on to the next steps. If I answered no, click on that box. It walks you right through it. It also, on the home page, will give you an opportunity to read everything about the very specific qualifications and eligibility criteria that homeowners must meet. It's going to help some people, but 4 million, I think, is a little high of an estimate. There's a lot more people that need a lot more help. And one of my concerns is that President Obama has referred to some homeowners as "we are helping responsible homeowners," which kind of denigrates everybody else. If you're late on a payment, you must be irresponsible. If you lost your job, you must be irresponsible.
Yeah, I have a real problem with this. I think that just like, you know, with welfare programs and just like with anything, frankly, anything. I mean, you know, of unemployment, workers' comp, you know, I mean, there's always going to be a few people who game the system and screw things up. But they are such a minority. The group that concerns me, frankly, that has been really demonized is, and I've known a few people who have done this, are the people who, during the peak of the housing bubble, there were these companies that were coming into towns and setting up seminars on how you too can become a millionaire with real estate. And they would, and you go to this weekend seminar and they teach you how to go out and find a property, a distressed property or whatever, buy it, fix it up a little bit, turn it into a rental property, and build basically a little mini empire for yourself as you know, on debt, as a real estate mogul. You know, frankly, I have a friend who, you know, back in the 80s and 90s did this based on one of these programs and ended up, you know, $4 or $5 million to the plus, you know, did quite well with it. But the problem is that a lot of people came into this, you know, 6 months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago, and then they got caught. And many of them took bad mortgages in order to buy properties that they were going to rent. And they thought that they were being entrepreneurs. They thought they were being smart investors. They had been sold a bill of goods by these hustlers who were doing these programs, these $125 weekend workshops. And they went out and with the very best of intentions tried to, you know, grab part of the American dream and be a small business person. And now they've got four mortgages that are resetting. They got renters who aren't paying their rent. They don't know what to do. And they're considered the investor class. And in many cases, they were, you know, hairdressers and candle makers, to quote Sir Edmund Burke.
Well, there's plenty of blame to go around, from the people who were in the trenches that were putting on these programs, all the way up to the investors on Wall Street that were buying pieces of the loan pools.
Yeah.
The problem here is, again, talking about responsible and irresponsible homeowners, I think the discussion should be focused on responsible and irresponsible investors, underwriters,
and lenders. Yeah, and lenders. This is just—it's just like my saying that, you know, we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States. We've got to stop demonizing the individuals and start looking at the institutions and the corporations. Robert in Fort Lauderdale, you got a question for Alan Jablonski? We got a minute before the break here.
Okay, I do. Alan, thank you for taking us. Anyways, I was wondering, and I haven't heard this brought up, why couldn't the loans be restructured in this manner? A low interest rate is fixed, accounted to that loan, and the amount on a principal would be adjustable. In other words, the current rate of the home or the cost of the home would be $200,000, but they purchased it for $300,000. After a year, they get a loan restructured for that low interest rate for that payment, with every year being rechecked for its new value until it gets to the $300,000. That means people can make a lower payment for the $200,000 home, yet still be on the hook for the entire purchase, which takes the pressure off the banks. No reason for them not to restructure it. People stay in their homes, and even helps people who are not currently in foreclosure, but it could be because of lost jobs in that by restructuring.
Yeah, I think we got it, Robert. Alan will answer you on the backside of this break here. We've got to take a moment and stimulate the economy here on the Tom Hartman Program. Alan Jablonski is with us. Alan, you're still there, right? Okay, great. We'll pick up your answer right here on the other side of it. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back. Our telephone number 1-866-987-THOM, 987-8466, and 503-796-2324.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Individual.
Welcome back to your radio support group for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Program. Alan Jablonski on the line with us, licensed mortgage broker and attorney. And what's the exact phrase there, Alan? Licensed realist. Yeah, licensed mortgage broker. I got it right. So, Alan, the answer to the question just before we took the break.
Well, the the caller's suggestion is basically, you know, the promissory note that homeowners signed is a contract, and any modification is going to be a new contract, just modifying the old contract. And what the caller suggested is that, and the problem is that he's suggesting an adjustable contract. And, you know, these loan servicers, they are in the business of collecting a check and dividing it up between the investors. Just to get a interest rate reduction takes them 3 months.
Right.
You know, they are not geared to help these people. And when the homeowners are calling their loan servicers trying to get help and modifications, they're not running into problems because these people are totally obstinate. What's happening is that they don't know what they're doing. They're not bill collectors.
Right.
They're not attorneys. They're hiring a whole bunch of people and they're trying to train them in a short period of time. And the reality of it is, in my communications with them, is they don't know what they're doing.
Right. So the bottom line is, we've got what we've got. We've got this program. It's a good starting point. It's a shame that Henry Paulson didn't keep his word, as you said in a note to me earlier, and use the TARP money to help out homeowners. That would have dramatically reduced the problem here. Instead, he gave the money to his banker buddies, who are continuing to draw multimillion-dollar salaries and jet around the world on their private jets. And my words, not yours. And but anyhow, we've got the problem that we've got. So let's continue with questions, or we've got the program that we've got. We've also got the problem we have. Let's continue with some more questions about that. Is it Dawan in Detroit?
Yes. All right. I have two things. One, I really do think that it is the loan officers, because I had a mortgage and I was a electrician at Chrysler, so I made somewhere close to $100,000 a year. I was given a subprime loan, and I really didn't understand why, because I didn't have a bunch of bills. The only bills I had were college loans. And they basically, you know, switched my mortgage companies around for a few minutes for the first couple of months. And then afterwards, I was stuck with another company, well, two companies, because they broke the mortgage up. And then I ended up getting into a situation and got foreclosed on, but it was primarily due to the fact that one of my payments came up missing. They had the payment, but it was missing. So they waited until, to make a long story short, my final date of my foreclosure. Before then, they were acting like they didn't know what I was talking about. So I called them day after day after day, month after month. But finally, once I got foreclosed on, they ended up sending me a check for the money that was missing. That was one. Number two, why won't we just change the whole mortgage process so that it'll be more so like cars, where we're not paying so much interest before we actually pay money on the principal, and that way Wall Street won't have so much room to play with the money, and that could kind of prevent houses from being upside down on their mortgage a little bit, because instead of 30 years, we'll be paying a house off in 15 years. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to have an $80,000 house on a 30-year mortgage when you have $80,000 cars being paid off in 6 years. And that's really what I had to ask in any of your comments.
Alan?
Okay, I think there's actually two questions. The first part is that if the facts that you related about getting a check back after you were foreclosed on, you need to contact an attorney and not talk to your loan servicer about how they wronged you. You need to find an attorney in your area, either a consumer rights attorney, but they have to have a real estate background and understand the mortgage industry.
He needs to sue the hell out of these people.
You may have a very good case. The devil is always in the details with each case. It's different, There are two ways to attack a loan and try to get a modification. There is the first is when they do the loan, did they violate the Truth in Lending Act or RESPA? It has to be egregious. It can't be, I didn't get my little booklet, my HUD booklet, when I purchased the house. It has to be something that really affects the contracts. And the second thing is that you can attack the servicing, and a good lawyer knows how to go at these things and get the information. Now, your second topic is, why did they make it? They have 15-year loans. The amortization schedules are set up so that you're not paying huge payments at the beginning. If you changed an amortization schedule to make it kind of flat through a 30-year period, your payments on the front end would be huge, and then they would shrink over time. No one could be able to afford a home.
Well, the one thing you can do, though, is you can get a 30-year mortgage and just toss an extra $100 into your payments every month and ask that that be added to the principal, for example.
Absolutely. If you make an extra payment a year, one extra monthly payment a year in total, you can shorten your mortgage by 6 years. That's a reasonable estimate.
And you pay a whole lot less interest. You know, that's what Louise and I always did. Whatever we could afford. Sometimes it was $20 a month. Sometimes it was $200 a month. You know, back in the 70s and 80s when we first were buying houses and had mortgages, and I would always do that to try to, because I frankly was incensed by the fact that the banks were actually, you know, the rate was 7% or 10% or whatever it was. We had one that was 13% back in the 70s. But the actual amount of interest that the bank was collecting on a year on that in that year was like 95%.
Right.
I mean, that's nuts. Anyhow, back to the questions. Brian in Pittsburgh, you're on with Alan Jablonski. AJConsumerWatch.com is website, by the way.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My question is this. I have a second mortgage on my house with some terms that are really unreasonable right now in this economy for me. Is there any way I can get that renegotiated? I've tried working with them, City Financial, and it's failed.
Well, the City Financial is actually the only loan servicer who's talked about agreeing to the bankruptcy rules, so that's a fallback. You have to kind of push your way through it. The benefit of using an attorney is they take you more seriously. We've just talked about partial write-offs with one of the loan companies. And they asked me not to mention their company name yet because they're thinking about it. And the partial write-off would work like this. If you owed $500,000 on a $400,000 house and the net present value is $400,000, they would forgive the $100,000 and you would only pay interest on $400,000. And the only caveat to that is that they would if your home value ever increased above $400,000, that's part of the bank's. That's the bank's property from there on out. They get that money
up to a cap of $500,000, up to a cap of the original.
Oh no, there's no cap. It's just that was just an example. If you're underwater, they would write down what you owe to the net present value.
But what if the house becomes worth $600,000 or $700,000 over the course of the time you're living in it? Does that mean that you now owe that amount to the bank, or am I misunderstanding what you're saying?
Well, what we're trying to work out is that the bank would, if the original loan amount was $500,000, and this is just an example, you would end up, the bank would be able to get their $100,000 back.
Right.
That they wrote off.
But no more.
That's what we're trying. I hope they cooperate. As far as the second mortgages go, they are portfolio loans, 90% of them. So Citi probably owns that loan. They don't have to go to investors and, you know, a pool of investors of 30 and get an okay from all of them. You need to find out. One of the great things about going to the financialstability.gov is that you can go to the Making Home Affordable Refinance page, click on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's links, fill out the information, and they will tell you, I don't know how long it's going to take, but they will tell you whether or not Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac owns that loan. Now, second mortgages, they won't own, but for people with first mortgages, and I just wanted to throw that out there for people who want to check.
And the advantage of that is that they're more readily eligible for help under this new program?
Correct.
Okay. Brian, answer your question.
Not really, because, you know, it's at a 13% interest rate now. They wanted to drop it down to 12 and extend the term 5 more years, which is really not doing many good. I can only negotiate at the branch level. There's no main number at corporate to call. And the other thing I want to mention is you said Citi is participating in that bankruptcy write-down, and that's not true. We're bailing them out with $45 billion of our taxpayer money, and they're paying a lobbyist $2.8 million to water down that loan to say that they will only accept a write-down if a home was purchased after a certain date. So that's not exactly true. They're taking our tax dollars.
Got it, Brian. Brian, we got 15 seconds.
Let me make it clear. They've agreed in principle. The law hasn't been passed yet, so they're not doing it right now.
Yeah. Okay.
The law passed before Citi will participate. Whether or not they come through with their promises is another question.
So, since only the branch will talk to him, is there any way to kick butt beyond that?
He needs to hire an attorney.
Yeah, that's so often the answer to these things, and I realize it's not just because you're an attorney. I've seen this as well.
I hate to be a shill for the industry.
Yeah, no, you're not. Because I get it. The every single bank and every single real estate company has lawyers, and that's what you need on your side. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Tom Hart. Truth in Broadcasting, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 9 minutes before the hour, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Alan Jablonski's with us, the attorney and licensed mortgage broker, AJ, as in Alan Jablonski. ConsumerWatch.com is his website. Alan, we've got a whole board full of calls. We've got only about 5 minutes left in this segment, maybe six. So I'm asking my callers if you can keep your question really short. And Alan, to the extent that you can keep your answers short, let's try and get through as many as we can. Woody in Litchfield Park, you're on with Alan.
Well, hello again, Tom. Yes, I'm still trying to push that idea of letting the borrower buy his own mortgage back. Yesterday's New York Times, the countrywide executives are now buying these mortgages for as low as 7 cents on the dollar and expecting a 50% return on their investment for buying these mortgages so low.
Okay, good one, Woody. Alan, there's no provision like that in this legislation. Do you know of anything coming down the road?
No, there isn't, and it's not being discussed. And if I gave my opinion on the individuals that helped cause this problem, I'd probably get sued.
Okay. Deanne in McMinnville, Oregon. You're on with Alan Jablonski.
Hi. I am one of the unemployed. I've been in my house for 16 years, and now I'm struggling to keep up with the mortgage because of being on unemployment. Would this package help me in any way? I have a really good interest rate right now at 4.875 and have 14 years left on my loan. Will I have any chance of refinancing to 30 years?
Without everything has to be documentable right now.
Uh-huh.
The new program requires you to show your income. What I suggest you do is you contact your servicer and you let them know, you know, I've been with you for many years and now I'm unemployed, and you look to request a forbearance. And ask them for time, 6 months, a year. Let them tack on the principal to the back end of your loan. But I would, your key word is forbearance.
There you go. Good luck, Deanne. Rob in Iron Mountain. I'm sorry, I don't know what state Iron Mountain is in, Rob.
Don't worry about it. It's where I consider you a friend. I got a real quick question here. It's where
okay.
The whole thing is when you really come right down to it, there is the predator and there is the prey. All these people out here that took and all of a sudden got moved into a house that was where, there was a predator out there that had to be able to take and sell them something that they couldn't afford. Let's go after the predators. How do you do that?
Well, that's going to be up to the politicians, but as a friend of mine told me the other day, this was basically the largest racketeering group that has gotten together and conned the American public, and they knew the finances, and the homeowners didn't, and they should. And the fault lays with the investors and the lenders.
Yeah, and Paulson and his buddies are letting him walk off with millions. Robert in Portland. Hey, Robert, you're on with Alan Jablonski.
Hi, Alan. My question is regarding the Hope for Homeowners program. It seems like with the negative equity out there right now, we're not addressing that issue like we should be. 55% of notes, remodified notes, are in default already. Why is that program such? Why is there such a detachment between that program and the investors?
Well, what happened with Hope Now was the first program. Then there was Hope for Homeowners. Both of those programs were, again, paper tigers. Everybody thought they were going to be able to get a modification. Back over
the banks said, sorry, we're not going to play, right?
Yeah, 2008, throughout 2008, they were giving 1 and 2 year low interest payments, and then they would go right back to the unaffordable payments, and the homeowners figured it out. It was like doing an option arm loan all over again.
It was just extending the scam. So now we're seeing some real progress, but it's very small. It's just a start. Lee in Pinckney, Michigan, you're on with Alan Jablonski, ajconsumerwatch.com.
Yeah, I'm wondering why they don't try to set up some type of a program along the lines of the Rural Economic Development Program where my mom had one. I'm a realtor. And what they did was they based her payment on her income. If her income went up, she was checked yearly to make sure what her income was. If her income went up, she was charged more for that. And at the end of the time, if her house gets sold, they have a right to recapture a percentage of what it sells for. If it's over what her original mortgage was.
Thank you, Lee. Basically behind the partial write-off, and hopefully more lenders are going to consider this as an option. The problem is they don't want to give up, $100 versus
right.
$10,000.
This is where we need to use the force of law to go in and kick their asses.
Absolutely.
But it's going to take some time. Rob in New Jersey, you're on with Alan Jablonski.
Hey, how you doing? I'm current on my mortgage. There was only once in February where I was more than 30 days late. They haven't reported me yet, but I think they're going to report me to the credit reporting agencies. At that time, I'm worried my credit card interest rates are going to go up, and then I'm really not going to be able to afford my mortgage. I posed this scenario to the servicer, and I'm trying to get them not to report me. Any help on how I can get them to do that?
Okay, well, if you were over 30 days late, they're actually required to report you as 30 days late. But here's the thing. Your credit card companies cannot raise your interest rate on your cards without notifying you of it. They have to send you a letter. They have to say, we're going to raise your rate. You can say no. Now, they may cut you off the card and you can't use it anymore. But they can't arbitrarily raise your interest rate without you okaying it, and that would be you using the card again. So just be ready to have your cards cut off on you.
Is this a new law, or has this always been the case?
This has always been the case.
Yeah, so you can simply say to the credit card company, sorry, you can't raise my rate, but the way that you agree to raise the rate is by using your card one more time. So you just have to get a different card or something
like
that.
And make sure that you put something in writing and that you fax them a letter saying, I'm
got it.
Get everything in writing. Everybody who's working with a mortgage company, a loan servicer, get everything in writing. Get their names. Get the date you talked to them, what they said, what you said.
Right.
Build your case for an attorney if you need one down the road.
Right, and if you don't get it, if you can't get it in writing, put it in your own writing so that you've got it, all of the above. Alan Jablonski, ajconsumerwatch.com, his website, his book, Navigating the Mortgage Maze. Alan, as always, a great show. Thank you. A great hour. Thank you for being with us and answering our questions.
It was wonderful being with you. I hope everyone gets their answer soon.
Yeah. Amen. Thanks, Alan. Susie Orman up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club. Providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. As legislation is slowly moving through Congress, let your member of Congress know that these modifications to the Bankruptcy Act that will allow homeowners to include mortgages in their bankruptcies in a more healthy fashion, as Alan Jablonski was talking about, something you support. He'll have more information on that at his website. We will at ours, and we'll get to that. 12% of Americans right now behind on their mortgages or in foreclosure. Predatory lending with a smiley face going on. Salon.com exposing this whole thing of mortgage brokers and real estate agents getting together and basically learning how to hustle people, how to hustle them out of one bad loan into another bad loan. The New York Times reporting, you're dead. That's not going to stop the debt collector. Isn't that wonderful what's going on? It's an absolute disaster. 28 years of Reaganomics has brought us an absolute disaster. What do people do? How do you get through this? Susie Orman has a solution, or in part. She's got a variety of good plans and programs to deal with your own personal finances. Her new book, Susie Orman's 2009 Action Plan, Keeping Your Money Safe and Sound. Her website, SUZEORMAN.com. Susie Orman, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. On your own show on Valentine's Day, you went off on an absolutely wonderful rant about the benefits of marriage and why this should be extended to gay folks. And with Prop 8 now being debated in the California courts, I was hoping you could just quickly revisit that before we get into any of the other details of today's finances.
Yeah, I just think that when somebody is a healthy tax-paying citizen and they earn money, they pay taxes, they should have the same rights if they choose to be in a same-sex relationship. They should have absolutely the same financial rights as a heterosexual married couple. And it is a travesty that that doesn't happen today. It is a travesty that a lot of these states have actually taken away the legal right to be married. And it's just really, as I said on my show, and I've said for a while now, it's just a travesty. And hopefully one day that will change.
Amen. And what people have to get is that at the legal level, and that's what we're talking about here, is laws and states and courts and things like that. At the legal level, marriage is simply a contract that confers that once that contract is consummated, that contract then causes the state and the county and the municipality and the federal government to confer a whole bunch of different kinds of tax advantages and other, you know, opportunities, visiting somebody in a hospital, for example, that are not available to people who are not part of that contract. And why should gender have anything to do with this?
Yeah, and, you know, the last I looked, there were over 1,000 financial differences between a heterosexual married couple and a homosexual couple that happen to be living in the exact same way as the heterosexual married couple. And again, it's double taxation. It's rights not being able to have certain rights to visit somebody in a hospital. And it goes on and on from there. Again, it is a travesty, and it has got to change.
So let's get right down to brass tacks here, Susie Orman. How do you keep your money safe and sound in this, you describe it as a shaky economy. I describe it as an ongoing plane crash. What do we do?
Well, first of all, the truth of the matter is, Tom, nobody has any money to keep safe and sound.
Yeah.
If you think about it, when I travel throughout the United States or I talk to people and I ask them, what do they have? Here's what they tell me. They have credit card debt. They have car loan debt. They have student debt. They have personal debt. They have debt that's on their 401k because they borrowed money from their retirement accounts. They're underwater in their homes. Nobody has an emergency fund at all. So nobody really has any money whatsoever.
Right.
So the real question then starts to become, what do you do so that you can go from having nothing to something? What do you do when you owe more on things than what they're worth? And I have to say that even though it's not easy to say these things, that one has to learn, when do you let go and when do you keep holding on?
By let go, are you talking about bankruptcy?
Well, it's either, you know, you can let go in bankruptcy, you can let go by short sales or deeds in lieu of foreclosure or walking away from properties. Mm. You can let go by just saying, you know what, I cannot take money out of my retirement account to pay for my mortgage that I'm already 6 months behind, and it's only going to catch me up for these 6 months, and then in another 3 months I'm behind again.
Right.
And I don't have an income right now, so therefore this new mortgage relief program isn't going to help me at all, because you have to have an income in order to either refinance or have a loan modification.
Right.
So when do you start to look at things and go, all right, and become very realistic about your situation, understanding what laws do protect you, the laws being such as that any money in a retirement account is absolutely protected against bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are going to have to let go, if you're going to have to move on anyway, because there's no chance for you to keep anything because you really are over your head in every possible way, whether it's your fault or not, doesn't even matter today.
Mm-hmm.
It's you need to know, when do you not touch an account? When do you touch an account? You have got to have a plan of action so you don't make your situation worse than it already is.
You know, Susie, there are some rules about when you can and can't move money. I know that, for example, in a married – I actually have some friends who some years ago they were getting into some very, very risky investments that were involved a lot of money, and they got a divorce, and the husband put everything in his wife's name, and they knew that they would have to wait 2 years before there would be a firewall there, basically.
Yep.
So that the assets would be protected and they could continue with this investment. It ultimately worked out well, but that was before the great crash. I'm not sure where they're at these days, but my point is that I know with that kind of thing, I know with when my dad died, that there was certain times that you can, you know, give money, move money from one person to another and have it protected or not protected. What you said, you know, 401ks and retirement programs, I'm assuming Roth IRAs and IRAs and SEP accounts and things like that are protected against bankruptcy. If you moved a whole pile of money into it today and declared bankruptcy tomorrow, wouldn't they just come back and say, sorry, this is a fraud?
Well, you have to remember that you can't move a whole lot of money into a retirement account at once.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, in a Roth IRA, the most you can, if you qualify for it income-wise, is $5,000 a year if you're under 50, $6,000 if you're 50 and over.
Right.
If you're working for a corporation and you have a 401k, well, you're going to have to do it. It's not like you can go to that corporation and say, here is $50,000, hide it for me.
Right.
The retirement
unless
account,
you're Donald Trump.
Possibly, but I don't even think the good old Donald could do that. So it's you have to understand. So it's do you see what I mean? So it's not like you can use a retirement account in a scheme,
right,
so to speak. It's not going to hide that which you need. And the truth of the matter is, you shouldn't be hiding stuff.
Right.
I mean, if you have the intent to defraud, that is a far bigger crime and a serious, you know, offense.
Right.
You don't want to go down that route, people, because they'll find out.
Yeah.
They will find out. What you're looking at, though, is legitimate things. You have money in a 401k. You've been putting money there. It's the only money you have left. Maybe all you have left to your name is $40,000 in your 401k plan,
right,
and you don't have another penny. Do not take money out of the 401k plan to continue just keeping going by, because before you know it, the $40,000 is gone.
Right.
Now you don't have any money to keep you going by, and now you have to claim bankruptcy, and now you don't have that $40,000.
Right. Excellent advice. By the way, you're going to stick around for a little bit and we can take phone calls?
Yes, sir.
Let me give out our phone number, 866-987-THOM, 987-8466. And outside the country, or people who want to call direct, 503-796-2324. We've got a couple of lines reserved for that. We're talking with Susie Orman. She has a new book out and her 2009 update, Susie Orman's 2009 Action Plan, and keeping your money safe and sound. And, of course, her website, SUZEORMAN.com, SusieOrman.com. Susie, for those, what's the best planning in the minute we have before we go to the break here right now. What should people be doing with money that they have, any money that they have in their 401ks, investments, things like that? What are your thoughts on that?
Depends on your time horizon. I've said for a long time now that I thought that we would see the Standard & Poor's 500 go down to at least 660. Did I think it would get there this quickly? I'll be here to tell you I'm absolutely shocked that it got here. Almost, you know, we're like 20 points away from it as we speak right now.
Yeah.
So I'm shocked that it took that quick to do that. So time horizon, everybody. If you have 10, 15, 20 years or longer, relatively what you should be doing in your 401k plan is just little by little keep dollar cost averaging in and suck it up. But you better seriously have at least 10 years, hopefully longer. It's sooner than that. People, you should not be in this stock market.
Yeah. Well, I've been on this program for 4 years now predicting the Dow is going to go to 5,000. So we'll see what happens.
I need to call me up and tell me.
You should have been listening, Yes. But we have Suzy Orman with it, SUZEORMAN.com, her website. She'll be right back answering your calls at 866-987-THOM.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Men.
The multinational corporations would, in many cases, really rarely to know all about. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program. Suzy Orman with us. She has a new book out. She, of course, the brilliant, internationally acclaimed personal finance expert, author, and columnist. Her new book, Suzy Orman's 2009 Action Plan, Keeping Your Money Safe and Sound. And her website, SuzyOrman.com, taking your call. Suzy, ready to take some calls?
You betcha, sir.
Okay, let's go for it. Kareem in West Palm Beach, Florida. You're on the air with Suzy Orman.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I always listen to you.
Okay.
Well, I have a question for Suzy Orman. I'm 33 years old, and I'm putting a little money away every paycheck on my 401k. But is that all I could do? Or I mean, I'm worried about, like, okay, 50 years is going to come around pretty quick, 60, whatever, I have to retire. And what else can I do to make a long-term investment? That's
well, did I hear this correctly? You're calling from Palm Beach, correct?
Right.
Do you own a home?
Yes, I do.
Do you plan to stay in that home for the rest of your life?
Well, if the development's okay, yeah.
Okay, so but let's think about this. So here you are, you're putting money aside in a 401k plan in the hopes, and all you can do is hope when it comes to the stock market, that it will grow enough so that by the time you retire, that it will generate enough income for you to live on. Now, most people want income to live on to pay their bills, and their largest bill happens to be the mortgage on their home. So you live in Palm Beach, where homes are still relatively expensive, even though we've seen them decrease pretty much in value there. Do you own your home outright currently?
No.
No, how many years do you have left on your mortgage?
I just bought it 2 years ago.
Right, 2 years ago, so you bought it at the height of the, you know, real estate market. You're probably underwater in it, and yet you're still going after, you're still deciding that you may want to stay there. So if you decide that you want to stay there and maybe want to retire in that home for the rest of your life, I would still say to you, depending on how much you're underwater, because if you're too much underwater, it would probably be better to let go, but that's
another. I should let go because I'm about $100,000 underwater.
And how much was the house altogether?
It was $250 when I bought it, and now they're selling for like $240, $250. Oh, I mean, I'm sorry, $140, $145, somewhere around.
All right. So here's the first thing that you should be asking: not just what should you be doing with more money. The first thing you should be doing is finding out, is there some part of this new program with the mortgage relief that you could get your interest rate down, that you can do something with it? But I got news for you. If you're more, you know, you have a $250,000 mortgage and the house is worth $100,000, I don't know. That, Tom, is like the situation that I was saying. When do you let go and when do you keep it? Do you do a short sale? It's a primary residency. You're not going to have any tax implications. However, be very careful because the state of Florida is a recourse state. So you may have signed a loan, especially if you're making money, that they can come back and have recourse on you for the difference between, you know, what you let it go for and whatever. So just check all of that out. But what I...
Well, what should someone do? Should they file for bankruptcy and then I hear, like, it's not covered or whatever? I
mean, here's the thing.
It's like I'm in a...
But you're making good money right now, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm making decent money, and I'm...
So if you're making decent money, then you don't want to claim bankruptcy. If you're making decent money, and let's just say you love this home and you don't care, and you want to stay in this home at all costs, the point that I was going to say to you is that what you might want to do with extra money is start to pay down the mortgage on this house so that eventually you own it free and clear because that's where you want to stay. So that's just one possibility for you. But when you're this much underwater, I don't know if that's what I would be
so
doing.
So what happens to people, I'm sorry, what happens to people when they just walk out and let the bank take over? I mean, what...
Here's what happens. And through
what's going to happen the rest of my life?
I'll tell you. Here's what happens in the year 2012. You can do this between now and 2012. If for whatever reason you do a short sale or you do a deed in lieu of foreclosure or you just walk away, which I don't recommend because that's not a great thing to do to your neighbors, but that's besides the point here, is that the current law, if it is your primary residency, they cannot come after you for the difference, taxes, I mean, from the difference between what it's worth right now, let's say $100,000 and the $250,000 that you owe, so that $150,000 difference, they cannot come after you. If this was a rental property, however, the bank will issue a 1099 on the difference, and then if you are not insolvent at the time that you walked away from this home, did a short sale, or did a deed in lieu of foreclosure, you will owe taxes on the difference. So you have to be very careful.
What about just sitting in the home for the next 10 years and the assumption that the housing market's going to turn around just like the stock market might?
Yeah, so that's what I was saying to him, Tom. If he's going to stay there and he's going to keep that home, then what he could do besides just putting his money every single month in his 401k, he could start to pay down the mortgage on that home.
Right.
So that, because at $200,000 or whatever it is his mortgage is, he has about a $1,200 a month payment.
Right, start tossing an extra $200 a month into that instead of
and
the 401k.
That's correct.
And pay down that home, and because the housing values in West Palm are going to come back in all probability. Kareem, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. We've got to take a break here. We're talking with Susie Orman, SusieOrman.com, her website, the internationally acclaimed personal finance expert, author, and columnist. Taking your calls, Susie Orman's 2009 Action Plan, Keeping Your Money Safe and Sound, her new book. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You know, it's not- Susie Orman with us. Susie Orman's 2009 Action Plan, Keeping Your Money Safe and Sound. Her new book just out, SusieOrman.com, SusieOrman.com. Her website, the internationally acclaimed personal finance expert, author, and columnist, and a person of whom I am a great fan. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Susie, continue with some phone calls here, eh?
Let's go for it, Tom.
Okay. George in Tempe, Arizona. You're on the air with Susie Orman.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? You know, I'm not sure if this is exactly on target because I'm actually calling sort of in response to a couple of weeks ago. You had a guest on who was giving advice about loan modifications, and
sure.
I'm actually a loan modification officer. And you were talking about how most of the loan modification companies are scams, or he was talking about it. And I'm here to tell you that they're not. And I'm here to tell you also that even with Obama's plans coming out, I actually went to see, I'm in Tempe, I went to see Obama speak at when he announced the housing plan. I listened to Geithner and Donovan's press conference. There are so many intricacies to this that the average layman has no chance of going up against these banks and getting what they need out
right.
of it because of the fact is the banks are still adversarial. They're adversarial.
Oh, absolutely. They're corporations that are trying to make a living. They're trying to make money. I mean, this is the bottom line. George, your point is well taken, and it's why Alan Jablonski was talking about get a lawyer. By the way, I want to ask my callers. We've got a million calls here for Susie, and not a whole lot of time. I mean, just another 20, 30 minutes here. Please keep your questions to as quick as you can, and Susie's going to keep her answers short. Susie, thoughts on George's comment?
Well, here's the thing. I've actually been working with the administration, so to speak, with some of the people who are responsible for writing this plan,
mm-hmm.
and they understand that it's complicated. They understand what's going on. There's a big difference between the people who are servicing these loans, the investors in these loans, the investors wanting certain things. It's a very, very complicated, to say the least. But with that said, we're actually trying, and I'm getting them trying to do this, to create a calculator, a question and answer format, so that you can fill it out, Tom.
Right.
You know if you qualify. You know how much money you'll save. But they're trying their best.
I think they've got a pretty good start over at financialstability.gov. They just rolled this website out.
Yes, they did roll it out, but they don't have certain things on there, and people are still very confused, such as, can you refinance your house if you have a first and a second on it?
Right.
And the answer is you can, but, so there's little things that still they're working on, but is it perfect? No. Is it a start? It is.
Yeah.
And while your caller, I just have to say this, while your caller, it's true that there are some honest loan modification programs out there with individuals. I'm so sorry to say, sir, the majority of them that we have looked into are not honest.
Yeah.
They are real estate agents that are just trying to make a living in any way they can.
Yeah. Salon.com, as I said, did this great expose on this just in the last, just came out yesterday, predatory lending with a smiley face, and they just
That's right.
they showed up at one of these workshops for loan origination officers, how to hustle people, basically. Susan in Menlo Park, California, you have a question for Susie.
Hi, Susie. Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I had a bankruptcy 1994. My debts were discharged. I still have on my credit report. It says something to the effect of past having had 9 or 10 credit cards, which was the case. I was had a serious problem then. Is it possible for me to get that information removed from my credit report?
Here's the thing. That information, believe it or not, is not really hurting your FICO score, so to speak. And you only care about information that's on your credit report that hurts your FICO score. Now, that's a whole other topic, why Experian isn't letting any of you buy an Experian FICO score anymore, but we can put a pin in that for this second. The longer information is on your credit report, the less effect it has on your FICO score. So something that is over 10 years old, if it's still on your credit report, it's not hurting your FICO score at all. So the truth of the matter is, who cares? Let it stay there. It's a waste of your time to try to get it off anyway.
There you go. Good. Thank you very much. Maria in San Luis Obispo, you're on with Susie Orman.
Hello.
Hello, Maria.
Oh, sorry about that. I called Chase yesterday after I read about the refinancing availability.
Yep.
And they said my house right now is valued, well, I owe $643. I bought the house for $750.
Yep.
And, of course, I can't refinance because the value has dropped in the house about $30,000. And I guess, anyway, so what they're telling me is that in order to refinance and to get a rate of 5.5, I have to pay points of 1.3. What do you think about that?
Well, here's the thing, is that in the area, again, I'm not exactly sure where you're calling from. Remember, a lot of these refinances as well as loan modifications, you have to be within Fannie Mae limits, which are 4.7.
I'm a jumbo, and I'm below the 720.
So you're below the 729 or 725, 790
right.
area. All right. So here's the thing. I think that's a high refinance fee.
Okay.
And And I'm still waiting for the answer back from the person that I'm dealing with on the economic committee. Is there, because according to many of these things, information that's coming out is that they're not charging you fees to do this, that it's all rolled in, that, you know, somehow we're working it out that way. So I would wait just a little bit if I were you, but I just think 1.5 points on almost, you know, $500,000-$600,000 is a whole lot of money. How long are you going to stay in this house?
Probably the rest of my life.
Right. And how much will it get your interest rate down for you?
About $600 a month.
So at $600 a month.
My present rate is at 7.
All right, so here's the thing. Even if you had to pay the 1.3% in points, if your loan is going to be reduced $600 a month, which is $7,200 a year, and you're going to stay in there for the rest of your life, it's going to take you not very long. It's going to take you about 1 year to recapture those fees, and then you're sitting pretty. So if that's the case, I'm here to tell you, just out of curiosity, how many years do you have left on your current mortgage?
We just bought the house in 2006.
All right, you had a 30-year mortgage, so now currently, you know, you have a 27-year mortgage approximately left, so you're going back to a 30-year mortgage where you're adding 3 more years on. If you could, on any level, and how old are you?
I'm going to turn 50.
Yeah, at 50, if on any level you could somehow spring it out and you could afford to amortize this over 15 years, 20, or 25 years, that would be far better off than extending to 30 years, because if you add on those extra 3 years of payments and the points, then you got to just look at it. Okay?
Or you can do it by the do-it-yourself method, which is simply adding to the payments that you're sending in every month and reduce your principal.
Now they're also wanting me to pay now mortgage insurance.
Yeah, it's an escrow account. Part of the law, the new thing is that you have to pay escrow accounts, these impound accounts, and that's just how it has to be. And if the banks currently aren't requiring them, they have 6 months to institute it so that everybody does have an impound account.
Interesting. Susie Orman answering your questions. Thank you for that call. Maria Veronica in San Francisco, you're on with Susie.
Hi, Susie. I got married in 2007. I'm a teacher in San Francisco, and I had purchased a home. I was able to put a substantial down payment, but I realize it was still a little funny. They said it was a teacher program, but it actually turned out it was just a scam. Anyway, when I married in 2007, my husband owned a duplex. His is basically tanking. He owes now more than it's worth. My house is still okay, but we're barely making payments. We have what's called the pick a payment plan.
Yeah.
And some months we have to pay, you know, below the interest. And now he just got laid off. And so my job is secure.
Can you live in the duplex?
That's what I've thought about. Like, which do we sell? What do we do? Should I sell my home?
Because you have some equity. You're not insolvent. Are you technically insolvent where you owe more now than you're worth?
In my home?
In all your assets and everything that you have.
As a couple?
As a couple. Probably, yes.
All right, so you take a look at that because, again, what you just have to be aware of is if you walk away or do whatever to your duplex, which is your rental property, remember you will be issued a 1099 because it's a rental, which is different than a primary home, and technically you owe taxes between the difference between what it was worth at the time you did that, if they foreclose on it, if you did a short sale, and your mortgage. Unless you are technically insolvent the day that you do that. So you might just think about that. However, if your expenses are cheaper by living in the duplex than they are in living in the primary residency, then I would do some changing here and I would go into my duplex, rent out all the other places, and I would get rid of my primary residency if I could.
Okay. Right now the duplex is rented and the rent is just about covering the payment.
But if you took away one of the places, so you have duplexes, you know, you have two, if when that's up, would you, if you lived in one of them, would that be cheaper for you than living in the house that you're currently living in?
I don't know.
That's what you have to figure out, girlfriend.
Okay.
In order to make decisions as to what you do, you have to know what does it really cost you to keep that which you have.
Yeah, there you
okay.
go.
Thank
Veronica,
you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Susie, thank you for the answers. We'll be back with Susie Orman answering your questions here on the Tom Hartman Program, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And more to come. Stick around as we pause to stimulate the economy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Developing a few more lines as this economy continues to go in the tank. Oh, man. Susie Orman with us offering some suggestions and help. Her new book, Susie Orman's 2009 Action Plan, Keeping Your Money Safe and Sound. Her website, SuzieOrman.com. And Susie, taking your calls. Jim in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Susie.
Yes, I guess I'm one of the few regular guys that does have some money. I have a good job. My wife has a good job. I have no unsecured debt. And at the end of the month, if the stock market hadn't crashed, I'd be retiring. So my 401k has gone from $400,000 to almost $200,000. My financial advisor and everyone else I hear says don't get out now because you bought high and you're selling low. But one of the funds, which used to be called guaranteed interest, it's called interest income. Over the 1, 3, 5, 10 years, it's had a return of 4.5%, while everything else is down 25 to 30%. So my question is, should I take that remaining $200,000 and put it in that fund so it is safe?
Here's my question to you. Did your advisor, when you had $400,000 in this 401k and it went from $400,000 to $350,000, tell you to stay in?
Yes.
And when it went from 350 to 300, did he tell you to stay in?
Yes.
And when it went from 300 to 250, he told you to stay in. And when it went from 250 to 200, he told you to stay in. So he has been wrong the entire time. And I am sure that you placed a call to him saying that you wanted to get out, and he talked you out of it. Is that correct, sir?
That's correct. A year and a half ago, I said, why don't I take this whole $400,000 and stick it in this safe spot.
Mm-hmm. And here you are asking another person, because the truth of the matter is, what do any of us know? We're dealing in a situation of totally unknowns, and anybody who gets on the radio or on the TV and says they know for sure this is what's going to happen, I don't know. I don't know how they know that. But this is what I do know for sure, that this is your money. And what happens to this money is going to affect the quality of your life, not my life, not Tom's life, but your life. And if in your gut, just like you did a year and a half ago, you thought you should get out and go into the 4.5% fund, and now you're wishing you had listened to yourself, if you're thinking that today again, why aren't you listening to yourself now?
Well, I'm about at that threshold. I've already taken the stuff I'm contributing now is only going into there. And if it goes any lower, I'm taking it all and sticking it in that one account.
You know, the other thing is, do I think, truthfully, that this market is just going to turn around and go up 100% from here and everything's going to be okay and you're going to recapture? No. I think we are going to bottom feed here for quite a while. You know, as I'm talking to you this very minute, the Dow is down 251 points. The Standard & Poor's is down 27, you know, almost 28 points. Those are huge percentages. Now, a lot of people will say to you, we're at the bottom. How do we know we're at the bottom?
Susie, if you look back at the last 14 major recessions in the United States and British history, going back 300 years, what you find is that typically stocks start to recover when the price-earnings ratio gets into single digits. P.E. ratios right now are at 23%.
That's right. We are not close.
That means taking the Dow down to 3,000. It wouldn't surprise me at all, frankly. As I said, I've been saying 5,000 for years. My long-time listeners know that. Although I'm not a financial advisor at all. I mean, you know, one of my sponsors is a gold company, but I say, this is not financial advice. That's what you do for a living. You know, I rant mostly about politics 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. This is a very, you know, unusual hour.
But what I do know, Tom, is that people need to make moves with their money that feel right for them.
Absolutely.
And if it doesn't feel right, if you're sitting there and you are sick to your stomach because you're watching it go away, when you're sick to your stomach, you become an employee that's powerless because you're thinking about something other than your job. Then what happens? Then you're one of the people that get laid off. If you're self-employed, you render yourself powerless because you're thinking about your money, and then your customers go away. Do what makes you happy, people. Do what makes you happy.
There you go. Mary in Fremont, California, you're on with Susie Orman.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi, Susie. The question I have for you, Susie, do you have some type of a yardstick that you would recommend when we receive our shareholder ballots and we're trying to make a decision in terms of voting for executive compensation or not?
Yeah, here's the thing. The yardstick I would do is are the companies that I'm investing in that are sending me these proxies, have they made me money or have they lost me money? Have they made me money, and even if they made me money, did they do it honestly? Did they do it because, you know, like what was really going on? And if it happens to be companies that had greedy, lying executives running it, I wouldn't be giving them any compensation. I would be doing what? I would be voting that they had to give back every penny they ever made from their pensions, from their retirement plans, from their options. They owe it to America. Are you kidding?
I'm glad to hear it.
Kidding?
Yeah.
So if as long as in these, just depending on the companies that you're talking about here, there are some that are legit. They've made money. They've made everybody money. Okay, let them be compensated. But if you're talking about a company that's underwater, that is part of this financial debacle, I wouldn't be paying them a penny if I were you.
Yeah, and in the meantime, let's move some of these CEOs into homeless shelters.
I mean, like, what is that about? Why do they still have their jobs? Can somebody just tell me?
Yeah, we have 35 seconds. Deborah in Beaverton, a real quick question. Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that break. I'm wrong. I'm sorry, Deborah. Susie Orman, SuzieOrman.com, the website. Susie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Anytime, Tom. And everybody, you stay safe and do what makes you happy.
There you go. Excellent advice. Susie Orman's 2009 Action Plan, Keeping Your Money Safe and Sound. Her new book, check it out, and SuzieOrman.com. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman. Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our show. Tom Hartman here with you. Congressman Wamp I think it's actually WAMP is how he pronounces it, or he would prefer that it's pronounced WAMP, the Republican, Zach WAMP, the Republican from Tennessee, going on MSNBC today to talk about health care. This is the point that when Ted Kennedy at the Democratic National Convention in Denver said health care in the United States should be a right, not a privilege, he spoke the absolute, ultimate, and most important truth with regard to the whole health care debate in this country. And that is that if the Declaration of Independence, one of the founding documents of this country, although not one of the legal documents, but certainly the founding document of this country, says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that's why we're creating this government, that's what this is all about. And if the Constitution in the preamble speaks of the general welfare, and that is a legal document, that is a not just a defining document, but a legal one as well. If they lay that out, if the founders laid that out, how can you have life? How can you have the general welfare be fulfilled if you have people who are sick and dying of that sickness, particularly if they're contagious sicknesses? But even at the individual level, what's the morality of this? Zach WAMP at MSNBC, here you got to hear this interchange. This is mind-boggling.
Listen, health care is a privilege. I do think that in some populations...
Well, it's a privilege, health care? I mean, if you have cancer right now, do you see it as a privilege to get some treatment?
I was just about to finish to say that for some people it's a right, but for everyone, frankly, it's not necessarily a right. Some people choose not to pay.
What people is it a right for?
And on it goes like that. But, I mean, this is the Republican mantra. And that, you know, for the Republicans in Congress who have very nice health care programs, thank you very much. It's a right, of course. And his whole pitch was, well, you know, some people choose not to have their employers deduct that couple hundred bucks a month out of their paycheck because they want to keep the money. And for them, it's a privilege. Give me a break. Health care is part of the commons. Healthcare is part of what we're all about in this country. If you want to have a right to life movement, you need to have a right to healthcare movement, because that is the ultimate right to life. I'm just boggled by this. I saw this in the news, and it's just like, you know, how can these Republicans, and we have been putting up with this stuff for how many years has it been since 1947? This is 2009. Was that 62 years, if I'm doing my math right? 62 years? In 1947, Harry Truman, President Harry Truman, proposed a national single-payer health care plan. Said, we're going to have Medicare for all. Wasn't even called Medicare back then. Lyndon Johnson got that one going. But we're going to have a national single-payer health care plan, and you know who shot it down? The Republicans, who had taken control of the House and Senate in the election of 46. They would not even allow the legislation to come to the floor for a vote. They shot that thing down. And Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican, thought it would probably be a good idea, but he wasn't going to take on his own party on this thing. Jack Kennedy talked about it, never did anything. Lyndon Johnson tried to get it to be part of the Great Society. The closest he could get was Medicaid and Medicare and have it be means-tested. Oh, it's only for poor people. Then it's called welfare, and then, of course, you know, during good times, the Meat Act comes out. We're going to reform welfare as we know it. We're going to do away with welfare as we know it. Come on. This is not welfare. This is we the people. This is the right of Americans to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The reason I mention this is because as we speak, Barack Obama, well, I'm not sure if it's as we speak, but today, Barack Obama is having his meeting on health care. And many of us were very concerned. I did not go off on this in quite the way that perhaps I should have. I've been going as far as I can on this program to give the Obama administration every benefit of the doubt, realizing that they have inherited probably one of the worst disasters that any president has inherited since Abraham Lincoln came into office. I mean, just an absolute disaster, from our standing around the world to two wars in the Middle East that we shouldn't have never have gotten into either one of them in the first place. to an economic meltdown that's the consequence of 28 years of insane economic policies by both Republicans and Democrats, initiated by Republicans. But there's a number of Democrats in there drinking the Kool-Aid. And my concern, as I've said, is that, you know, Barack Obama, President Obama, was basically saying, by selecting Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius as his HHS secretary and Nancy Ann DeParl as his advisor, his in-house chief advisor on health insurance. This is a woman, by the way, who, after she left the Medicare department, became a director for a bunch of different for-profit healthcare corporations, including Medco Health Solutions, Cerner, Boston Scientific, DaVita, and Triad Hospitals. And it really concerned me. And they were putting together this thing, and God bless Tim Carpenter and the folks at Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.com, or .org, rather, that they got out there and they mobilized people to say, get somebody who represents single-payer healthcare at that meeting. And finally, as a consequence of all the pressure, frankly, that I think PDA and others, but they were certainly at the forefront of this, put on this, and Physicians for National Healthcare Program, PNHP.org. I mean, there's a bunch of good groups who really, really went to the mat on this thing. And as a consequence of that, Barack Obama has invited Congressman John Conyers, who is the author of single-payer healthcare legislation, very similar to what President Truman proposed in 47, has invited John Conyers to that meeting. And so I think letting the president know, you can call the White House. The phone number's out there. It's easy enough to Google. And we're going to have to get that up on our website. We're going to have to revive our callcongress.org. I need to put that on my list of things to do here. That you can contact the White House and say, you know, President Obama, we've got your back. Don't be afraid of these Republicans. You know, let them go off all they want about, you know, health care is not a right, it's a privilege. Yes, it's a privilege. If you've got enough money, it's a privilege. It's your privilege, yes, but it's not a right. No, it's a privilege.
I was just about to finish to say that for some people it's a right, but for everyone, frankly, it's not necessarily a right. Well, some people choose not to pay.
Is it a...
Yeah, it's just a privilege. No, it's a... Come on! So, anyhow, thank Barack Obama for that, and let your member of Congress know that we need a national single-payer health care program. The insurance companies in this country, and it frankly, as I said, it concerns me greatly that HHS is now being populated by people who are insurance industry friendly. The insurance industry in this country is a massive, multi-billion dollar, incredibly wealthy, incredibly powerful industry that, in my opinion, does not deserve to exist in its current form. Now, I got no problem with there being insurance companies that insure above and beyond the baseline, you know, a basic Medicare program that covers everybody in the country, that will deal with any and all illnesses and will deal with them appropriately. But, you know, hey, if somebody wants to buy somebody living in Beverly Hills wants to buy an insurance policy that'll cover a boob job, I got no problem with that. If they want to buy an insurance policy that'll cover them if they're traveling in the third world or something like that, I got no problem with that. There are a lot of niches. There are a lot of specialty niches that insurance companies, particularly for the very wealthy, that insurance companies could fill, as they do in countries with single-payer health care programs or national comprehensive health care programs. Let them reinvent themselves as such. They're going to become one-tenth the size that they are today. But, you know, doesn't mean that they have to go. I'm not suggesting that they should be banned by law. But let's let every American buy into Medicare, or let's just simply create a national health insurance program and pay for it with taxes and let our taxes go up a little bit, because the bottom line is our costs are going to go down. As an entire nation right now, we're spending about $2.4 trillion a year on health care. And if we were doing it without the health insurance companies in the middle, it would only cost us somewhere between $1.5 and $1.75 trillion a year. And that's a current, you know, with all the wonderful programs we've got and doing it a little more rationally, we could probably get it down to 1.5. So people, instead of going to a $600 ER visit because their kid has got a really bad ear infection, they can make a $35 doctor visit. because they can go to the ER for free right now. I mean, you know how distorted and weird and whacked out this system is because it's a private for-profit system. Let's get the profit out of it. Let's get the for-profit hospital. Let's say if you want to run a hospital, you got to be a not-for-profit corporation. And you can't pay your CEO more than 20 times what your janitor makes. Nobody's getting rich in this business. You want to go into medicine, you go into it because you want to heal people. There is no shortage of people who have that calling. They are working in all over the world. Every industrialized country in the world has a national health care program, and they're doing just fine.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Provider.
By revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, it's our conservative alert for the day. Up, Louisiana Senator David Vitter, he who was named in the D.C. Madam prostitution scandal, has decided, being the great authority that he is on monogamy and marriage and all that sort of thing, Maybe he thinks that that's the way to keep a marriage functional is to, you know, visit a hooker once a week. I don't know. For whatever reason, he has co-sponsored the Marriage Protection Amendment. You know, I haven't actually read the Marriage Protection Amendment. I'm pretty sure that it amends the Constitution to say that marriage is only between a man and a woman. But given that it came from David Vitter, maybe it does require men to see a hooker once a week. Who knows? I mean, maybe there's some fine print we don't know about. He's also, David Vitter, the congressman from, or the senator from Louisiana, he's also trying, he's up for re-election in 2010. And so he's trying to shore up his good conservative credentials. How? Well, in the good conservative traditional way, by suggesting that funding for family planning and services should be slashed. No more birth control pills, no more condoms, no more sex education. Just get rid of it all. Yeah, brilliant. Kent in Paris, France, calling on the line that we have set aside for our international callers, 503-796-2324. Hey, Kent, what's on your mind today?
I appreciate you setting that line aside. It's actually made everything much easier. It's great.
Thank you.
I'm calling about health care. It's my one of my big personal interests, and I've used health care heavily both in the United States. I'm a U.S. citizen. Been living in France now for 7 years. And the difference between how it is administered is amazing. I'm sure you experienced that when you were living in Germany.
I did.
But I've had I had a serious accident about 2 years ago, and it actually happened in Croatia, and I had to pay the bill there, and it was surprisingly low. And that was completely refunded by the government. And you were speaking about something that is exactly how it is done in France, wherein you have single-payer coverage, and then you can have extra optional insurance to cover an assortment of other things, which we have done through my wife's work because that made the most sense for us.
Right.
So for extra things, if you have basic dental, but if you want extra coverage for whatever it may be, dental work-wise, you can get those things.
Right.
It
so if you want great. If you want dental coverage that would cover things like having the caps on your teeth or you know, yeah.
Braces, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there is a minimum of coverage for almost all of that. One thing that I always find disingenuous when I hear people debating about health care in the United States is when Senator Kennedy got treatment, they said, well, look, you know, only in America with private insurance could this possibly, you know, be addressed this quickly and have the best health care. And I remember you commenting on that when that happened, saying, well, we're not really worried about the millionaires and the billionaires. They're going to be okay.
Yeah.
It's about the rest of us.
Yep.
And the other people also said that look how it is in England, and they use England and most of the U.K. because their health care system isn't quite as good. And here in France, and I travel all throughout Europe, it's very, very solid. And sure, yes, your taxes go up, but it's fairly fixed. You know what your income will be.
Right.
And there
well,
are
the
no
UK supplies. Has been suffering from Margaret Thatcher the same way we've been suffering from Ronald Reagan. I mean, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were in lockstep. Tony Blair and Bill Clinton were in lockstep. Tony Blair and Bill Clinton were both more conservative than frankly, in my opinion, Dwight Eisenhower. You know, we have not had a liberal as a president since Lyndon Johnson, who, if you could set aside the Vietnam War, which is damn hard for me to do because I was a teenager during those years. I was out there yelling, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? But if you set aside and paid the price for it, but if you set aside the Vietnam War, Lyndon Johnson was a hell of a good president, but he was our last liberal president, frankly.
One day, if you have the time on a show, I would love to hear you riff about how you've said that William Jefferson Clinton governed more to the right than Nixon. And I understand many of those points, but I would love to hear you expound on that one day if you
sure.
have the time.
Well, Nixon was an advocate of protecting our trade policies. Or, he did want to open China, and he did start some of these things, but he was an advocate mm-hmm. of that. Nixon was an advocate of cleaning the environment. The EPA was started under Nixon. He did not oppose it. I had thought at one time that he had. He was actually apparently an enthusiastic advocate of it. There are a number of programs, not to say that Clinton was opposed to it, but, there are a number of areas where Nixon in today's world would not have cut it with the Republican Party. I guess, we should compare Nixon to today's Republicans rather than to Bill Clinton. But, times change. The Republican Party has been taken over by crazies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you listen just like what you're talking about, Mark Vitter, when you see, it's just absolutely, I don't even know what to call it. It's absolutely crazy to have this guy championing any morality whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's just, come on. Then he needs to be voted out in a couple of years.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Kent, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to our web stream there in Paris, France, and for calling the number that we'd set aside for international calls at 503-796-2324. Coming up next, Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress. We'll get an update on what are the news stories that might have flown under the radar screen of us and the rest of the media throughout the week. And say hi to Christy up in snowy Alaska. Catch up on the events of the day. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, Real Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Tom Hartman. Exposing the con in conservative, Tom Hartman here with you, and Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the Director of Strategic Communications. Who's the Director of Dumb Communications, Christy?
We haven't filled that position yet. We're still looking.
I'll apply. Keep me in mind. Oh, my. I just have to share something with you, given that we're talking about communications that I find amazing, and it's a story that I think our listeners will find interesting. I subscribe to a number of radio industry publications. Most of them are email newsletters these days. They started out as magazines years ago. Some of them still are. And two of them in the last 24 hours have commented, and this is all within the industry. This is people in the talk radio business talking to other talk show hosts, to salespeople, to people who own radio stations, program directors, that kind of thing, about how Rush Limbaugh has probably increased the net asset value of his show, the net billable revenue to his show, by at least $100 million in the last 2 months.
Oh, I absolutely believe it. And, you know, it's because he's been able to turn the very real divisions within the Republican Party into something that's a cash cow for him,
yeah.
Whether or not it's good for the party. I think that's what a lot of Republicans are so frustrated with right now, is the more that he can keep the party divided and just a complete wreck, the better, the more money in his pocket.
Yeah. And I know, you know, some progressives have been kind of obsessing on him. I have not mentioned him for more than a 2 or 3 minute period on any given day. And in part, it's because, you know, let's not give the guy any more free advertising. But really, he doesn't, you know, whether he gets it from me or not is pretty irrelevant when he's on MSNBC and every place else. But or for that matter, CNN carrying live his speech at CPAC. You know, or I guess it was recorded, but in any case, carrying the whole thing, it's kind of mind-boggling. But the dirty little secret that nobody knows is that every single time his name, or anybody else's name for that matter, I mean, if you can get the President of the United States to mention your name in your talk show host, your value just went up a whole bunch.
Right.
And Limbaugh is playing this thing like the brilliant violinist he is. I mean, the guy is a brilliant talk show host. He's loony. But he does know how to do talk radio, and he's laughing all the way to the bank.
Well, I'm kind of like you, as I've tried to take, you know, this big kerfluffle about what he's been saying and who's been saying it seriously. But every time I listen to the man, all I can think of was that New York Times Magazine piece about him that came out last year.
Yeah.
That talked about how he instructed his staff to walk around the house at 5 p.m. and light scented candles because he liked the house to smell like scented candles when he came home from work.
Yeah.
And it just sort of freaked me out.
Well,
his priorities were.
In fact, I had proposed a rule for myself, and I didn't follow it today, and I think it should be a rule for the entire media, is that whenever Rush Limbaugh's name is used, he is referred to as the $400 million man Rush Limbaugh, which was his last contract. And whenever Sean Hannity is mentioned, he should be the $200 million man Sean Hannity, which is what his last contract amount was with Premier, his syndicator. And, you know, we should make it very clear that these guys don't represent working people in the United States.
Oh, absolutely not.
Or give a damn about them.
Just because you can smoke a cigar and you're a little overweight doesn't mean you know what the average American's going through, especially when you live on a compound.
Right.
I think, you know, there were some pictures that were floating around on the blogs yesterday of it's an actual compound where Rush Limbaugh lives. It makes Donald Trump's Florida estate look like nothing. It's really crazy. I had no idea that it was that big.
Hey, $400 million will buy a lot of house
in
Florida. So, news flying under the radar, the SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the U.S.
Yeah, the Supreme Court had a big decision yesterday that I just wanted to make sure people knew about because it, for once, was something that I really, really thought they did a good job on when it came to businesses. And in a 6-3 vote, they decided that pharmaceutical companies can't hide behind the FDA if someone is hurt by their drugs by saying, hey, you know, the FDA said we were cool, so you can't sue us. And this particular case, a woman was injected with an anti-nausea drug in a way that was damaging, and they knew, as the drug company knew that you couldn't inject the drug this way, and the woman lost her arm.
Ouch.
And, you know, tried to sue because it wasn't on the label, and the FDA said, hey, if it needed to be on the label, you know, we would have put it on there. And so this court decision yesterday says that you can sue drug companies if you're harmed by their product and they cannot use the FDA as a shield. So it was a pretty good decision.
Yeah, that is. The Sudan. I did my show in March from South Sudan on the border with Darfur, and my son Justin went along with me, along with Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service and Jack Rice and Rusty Humphreys, and we actually spent a couple of hours with Salva Kiir, the president of South Sudan. We spent a lot of time with the UN folks and a bunch of people with Christian Solidarity International who flew us in, and a lot of time with people who were dying.
I mean, right.
You know, who were dying. And you wouldn't believe what we saw. And there's some, we got some pictures of it up on our website. But in any case, and we did our show live from there by satellite phone. I was talking with my son Justin about this yesterday because he's been following this very closely ever since he was there with me. And he's got some friends who've been going back and working there.
Mm-hmm.
And his comment was that the reason why the press secretary, Mr. Briggs, why the president's press secretary has been so wary, or the administration has been so wary about bashing Bashir, as it were, President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who was just indicted basically for war crimes, for genocide in Darfur, why our government hasn't done it so much is because, frankly, the only thing that has been preventing him from going into the cities in the northern part of southern Sudan, where there is oil now and the Chinese are cutting deals with him, and carpet bombing them, doing to them what he's been doing to Darfur, and the only thing that's preventing him from just an all-out total genocide in Darfur has been international public opinion.
Exactly.
And if he figures that that plug has been pulled and it's gone down the drain, there's nothing to stop this guy.
There really isn't. And, you know, the situation in Sudan has not gotten a whole lot better, but it seems like American attention for it comes in waves. And it has not been in the news very much recently until yesterday. And the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Bashir. And in response, things got really hot in the country. Sudan kicked out all of the humanitarian aid groups.
Yep.
We're talking Oxfam and Mercy Corps and the Solidarites and these groups that have been almost single-handedly providing the people of Darfur and in the rest of Sudan with things like food and medicine and sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
And you were over there. You saw firsthand.
Yep.
How necessary these groups are. So the situation just took a big, big, big turn for the worse yesterday with this International Criminal Court decision to arrest al-Bashir. I'm not saying they made the wrong decision. I'm just saying things got really hot.
We need some leadership on this because
exactly, and
Barack Obama is the perfect man to do it, being partially of African ancestry. If somebody would step up to the plate and say the Organization of African States needs to get together right now and tell Mr. Bashir his days are over as president of Sudan, and even if it's going to take, and you know I'm very wary of advocating warfare or violence, but even if it's going to take, or call for his military to rise up against him, or declare if all the other guys, I mean, tragically they haven't been able to do it with Mugabe in Zimbabwe, which is about as obvious and terrible as it gets.
Right.
But there needs to be an international declaration of the illegitimacy of this guy. We need to re-sign immediately the treaty that makes us a party of the International Criminal Court. The UN needs to get involved in this, because if he's kicking out those aid groups right now, he's doing it because he's planning on murdering a whole bunch of people in the next couple of weeks.
Well, exactly. And I think the big problem is that, frankly, a lot of people are concerned over whether or not they can afford to buy dinner next week, or if they're going to make their rent payments, with the economy as such. And that's why things like today's healthcare summit that's being hosted at the White House is so important, because we need to fix these big problems that are really close to our noses in order for people to then refocus on other huge, very important problems like what's going on in Sudan.
Yeah.
That will be happening.
Yeah, and fortunately, with the healthcare summit, finally we got one advocate of single-payer healthcare, John Conyers, the guy who introduced the single-payer healthcare legislation last year and the year before, and will again this year, I assume, if he hasn't already. Finally, under pressure, the Obama administration invited him. So, you know, we can hope.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I actually feel pretty good about this summit that's going on today. And right before it started, Lindsey Graham was even on MSNBC, and he's, you know, big Republican guy, and he actually was sounding pretty positive about what's going on at the White House today. So who knows? We might actually, maybe that's my newfound naivety and hopefulness coming through.
Yeah,
there might be something going on that's for good.
Yep. My son, Justin, who I referenced earlier, is apparently listening to the show. He just texted me and said, we need a no-fly zone in Sudan. That's a brilliant idea.
It really is. It is. But then you have to have someone who can enforce that no-fly zone, and I think that that's part of the problem, because, you know, the African Union just doesn't have the power to enforce things like that, and the UN is bogged down in Afghanistan and other places, so it's gonna take some manipulation.
We need to unbog the UN, because the UN is supposed to be about world peace and protecting, you know, people. Anyhow, we have a little less than a minute left here, Christy. $5 billion?
$5 billion? $5 billion, that's the amount of money that Wall Street spent on lobbyists and direct donations to politicians over the last decade. So the next time you're listening to how can they be getting all of this bailout money and what happened and why wasn't there any oversight last year and
why didn't it go to homeowners? Why is it instead going to bankers?
Exactly. Now we know. You get what you pay for, and $5 billion in the political game is a big chunk of change.
That's...
And there's a new report out called Sold Out, How Wall Street and Washington Betrayed America. and it directly shows that this money led to the current financial collapse.
And I'm assuming there's a link to it from AmericanProgress.org?
There is, on MikeCheckRadio.org.
MikeCheckRadio.org, great. Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress. Thanks, Christy.
Talk to you soon, Tom.
Yep, good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Mint.
What's it like in New York City? I'm 1,000 miles away, but girl, tonight you look so pretty. Yes, you do. Times Square can shine as bright as you. I swear it's true.
Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Truth in Broadcasting for a Change in America. Philip. Excuse me. I'm sorry, Philip. Tala with the Talk Radio News Service just got back from Iran. And pardon my pushing the wrong button. Hey, Tala, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
TalkRadioNews.com. Hillary Clinton has just proposed, if I'm reading this story right, that there be an international conference on Afghanistan and that Iran be invited to this. This is going to make the right-wingers in this country hysterical. I'm suspecting John Bolton is probably gasping and grasping for his nitroglycerin tablets right now to pop a few down and, you know, with his hand over his heart. Is that the case? And what is the situation in Iran right now?
Well, I think the situation is that many students, young folks, just don't have jobs. So the economy and the financial crisis are the main concerns for Iranians who just want to get a job and not have to deal with, you know, the international politics that's being preached by their president. I think Hillary Clinton
sort of like the United States over the last 8 years.
Yeah, a little bit like that as well, yes.
So, I'm sorry, I interrupted you in midstream. Continue.
Well, I mean, this is a president that preaches that he's part of the community. I mean, he lives in a very kind of moderate house in a moderate neighborhood, but overall is not understanding the voice of regular Iranians, you know, the youth that want to just kind of go on with their lives and do, you know, get a job, start their careers. There's just no industry, industry at all.
Isn't it so Iran is having an economic hard time, and I would think that the price of oil tanking is really making that situation far worse. Doesn't the president of Iran have very little power relative to at least one or two people above him? Isn't there a mullah who is really in charge of the country?
Definitely, and that's Khamenei, and he's really the kind of spiritual leader, the supreme leader is what they call him.
Mm.
But there are also various judicial councils. The thing about Iran is that the church and state are one. So when they're looking up, you know, laws and principles that apply to women, that apply to kind of liberties, apply to democratic values, they're using the Quran. And so it gets very difficult to kind of separate the two. It is a modern country relatively juxtaposed to the other countries surrounding it, Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq. But overall, I just think that this is a president that, you know, his time is getting up because he's just not providing those jobs that Iranians so desperately need inside Iran.
So is Ahmadinejad facing elections anytime soon, or is there some, I mean, is he a political risk?
There are elections coming up. There are people in parliament who just feel that, you know, he's not necessarily the best man for the job. Though, you know, he does get a lot of international attention. Whether or not that's been beneficial for Iranians is to say, I don't know, I can't comment on that. But overall, people now know him as the Iranian leader. This is a guy coming from, you know, it's a developed country, but it's still in a kind of developing world.
Right.
And he's really brought the issue or the agenda of Iranian people to the front of the, you know, international community's agenda. And I think that Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration opening up their hands and saying, well, we're willing to listen, which the Bush administration was just not willing to do at all. I mean,
right.
Just threatening with attacks and targeted missile attacks on different areas. It just wasn't helpful. And I think this may be helpful. I was just in Sharm el-Sheikh last week in Egypt, traveling with the United Nations Secretary General, and Hillary Clinton was there at that meeting for the reconstruction of Gaza. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people and Arabs felt that this is a person that was very pro-Israeli, and now she's taking a different stance. She's saying that there should be a two-state solution. Israel made a mistake by bombing schools and different centers where civilians were hiding out.
Well, you know, there's a significant minority and perhaps even a majority of Israelis who agree with that position. If you read
Haaretz
and you know, some of the publications within Israel, there's a hot debate in Israel about what their foreign policy should be. We just don't, by and large, have that debate here in the United States.
No, we really don't, and that's the misunderstanding, and that's what this conference is really there to do, to bring Arab leaders there, bring, you know, the various European and United States leaders together to come up with a plan. Hillary committed to $900 million from this administration towards reconstruction and rebuilding of Gaza. Mm-hmm. What needs to happen, though, I think two of the setbacks from this conference was that, one, there was no Hamas representative there. So Hamas representatives have been looting shipments of food and supplies that have been coming in from the United Nations. They need to be there at the table and say, okay, we are willing to agree with this system. Additionally, the borders are closed. So how to get all of those goods inside is still
That's going to require Israel's cooperation. Yeah. And that's where, you know, the political upheaval that's going on in Israel right now is not helping. Frankly, I don't think it's helping Israel. But my point is that trying to resolve the situation is a pro-Israeli position. But I'm curious, Hamas is, or Hamas, as you said, is at that funny nexus where, you know, that the IRA was at the time that, or perhaps a year or three before, Clinton helped, you know, and others. Helped broker a peace essentially with the United Kingdom and bring them into the fold. I mean, they're a political force. They're kind of they're terrorists. Not kind of. I mean, there's a terrorist force, and yet there's the potential for them to become a legitimate state. How does that transition happen? And we have a little less than a minute left here. I'm sorry for the complex question. Short time.
Well, from my viewpoint, the shipments of goods have to be kept safe and secure. From the Israeli side, you've got to open up those borders and let them in so Hamas doesn't get more angered and more starts attacking those kinds of shipments. Additionally, they have to be involved in the dialogue. One of the Hamas people said that Hillary Clinton is spewing out the same rhetoric that the George Bush administration was spewing out for the past 8 years. It's the same thing, but it's not the same thing. That's why the Obama administration, through Hillary Clinton and the Hamas leaders, through a kind of international body,
we're flat out of time. I'm sorry, but you know, thank you very much. I appreciate the feedback and the thoughts. Coming up tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie, and Governor Don Siegelman will be with us tomorrow. He's going to be on Rachel's show tonight as well, so check that out. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.